Okay, the question time today. Starting off, there we go. Hey, where does this start? Just one question, or anyway, I think the reason it hurts when I hear speech that is unnecessary. What's this? Is beginning. There's something here anyway. I think the reason it hurts when I hear speech that is unnecessary is that it feels like an unkindness. We all paid over $300 for the silence. Somebody wants their money back. For some of us, that is a lot. Some of us for a long way for the silence. If you could have to talk, could it be when you're sure no one is around? Or try this. Look at your mind if you speak. The next time, restrain the urge. Wait for it to pass. And look at the effect this has. Your meditation can only get better if you hold back. Okay. So, again, whenever there is time for there's any noise or speaking, please remember, it is you who disturb the noise. It's never the noise which disturbs you. It's an important point to always remember. But, in the same way that it's always good to try and restrain the speech as much as you possibly can. But you'll never be able to find it perfectly quiet. The only perfectly quiet place will be in your coffin when you're dead. And even that's not really always quiet, because sometimes it goes knock, knock, knock. But anyway, try and be quiet, but please, whoever had that question, don't get too upset, because you'll never get it perfectly quiet. And if you read the small print of the contract when you pay the $300, it said, it should say anyway, that sometimes there'll be some noise.
I can ask a question on that.
Yeah, go on.
I like this question, but in a community, a very small community,
yeah,
isn't there a balance here where members of the community try and help everyone else by being quiet, because this is a special idea? And so isn't there, whilst we can as individuals do that, and I wholeheartedly take that on, don't other individuals also take on to say, I will try and be as quiet as I can and
not annoy everyone else? Yeah, so it's true, everyone should try their very best to be quiet and not to speak too much. But sometimes there's always stuff, you know, which, you know, sometimes need to be said. So the usual rule is, and the nobility of the silence, is that when you're about to speak, you should think, reflect. The first reflection is, do I really need to say this? And if there's a tick there, yes, you pass that test. Then the test number two should be, do I really, really need to say this? And if that ticks as well, then the third test, do I really, really, really need to say this? And only if you pass the three tests can you speak. And by that time, the person's usually gone away anyway. So actually, try and hinder the speech and try not to speak too much as best you possibly can. Because it's helping other people as well. But if you do go past someone and they're speaking, you know, they speak and the sound is there and it disturbs you for a moment. But remember, every time you think about it, that's when you disturb yourself again. The old joke. Just the four monks who had the vow of silence, and one of them sneezed. And the first monk said, bless you. Second monk said, you have just broken your vow of silence. And the third monk said, haha, so have you. And the fourth monk said, I'm glad I'm the only one here who can keep quiet. So you see, you can't do anything. So if they've said something and you've thought, why don't they keep quiet? You've broken your inner silence. And that's more important than the outer silence. The mind doesn't react to what other people are up to. So keep your inner silence. Next question. Will I retain the mindfulness that I have built up during this retreat once I leave? And what can I do to build up my mindfulness in the outside world other than in meditation, in daily life? Didn't answer that question yesterday. The answer is, don't leave, stay here. But you haven't left yet. Who knows, you might die before Saturday. So what a stupid question that is. So stay in the moment. But anyway, but you do retain a lot of it, but you don't retain all of it. You lose a lot, but then you've gained this wonderful experience. So forget about, you know, leaving here until sort of, you know, just 1 minute before you leave. So don't be a person who's always, again, you know, on the next day. How many more days to go? If you are great, if you know the answer to that question, you're missing the point. Does meditation make you more attractive? Yeah. If you do that practice, say, this is good enough, this is good enough. Yes. Yeah, the answer, and nice to be around. That was the other half of the question. Does meditation make you more attractive and nice to be around? Sure. Because what you can do, actually, when you've got very strong meditation, you get psychic powers. And you can control other people's thoughts. You are like me, you are like me, you are like me. No matter how ugly you are, they will think, oh, she is so beautiful. Because you get into their mind and, you know. But it does make you more attractive, because the nicest part of a person is their heart. And if you've got a soft, kind, beautiful heart, then you are very attractive. And the old story, that this just happens, that some, I told this to one person here that said, when you go home, you know, your family will find you much easier to get on with, and much nicer person, a more peaceful person. So they'll probably ask for the dates of the next retreat, they'll buy you an air ticket, pay the money and say, off you go. And that's the sign that the retreat worked for you, because your friends and relations will see it and they will know it and think, wow, great. If one sees nimitta during deep meditation, does it mean that every time he or she meditates will have the same experience, or they don't have to start all over again, building up mindfulness, etc., each time they sit down and get started? If you get a check on Friday at the end of work, will you get a check on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday as well? Oh, it would be nice if that was the case. No, because the nimitta is, it's a paycheck. You're getting somewhere from your meditation. So you got that nimitta, had a nice experience, now you've got to go back to work again. And build it all up again. But the longer you go to work, the more promotion you get. And when you get promotion, the fatter your salary. Which means, as you meditate more and more, that nimitta gets brighter and it comes earlier. And after a while, you can retire with all the nimittas you ever want. Not only nimittas of jhana. So it actually becomes more frequent, more intense, as you practice more and more. But it doesn't come every time. You just hit the jackpot once. It doesn't mean you can hit the jackpot next time. Actually, just that reminds me of that story of Ayakama about hitting the jackpot. It's a very funny story, because monks and nuns, the good karma they've got. Because I checked this out with Anya, because Anya was her attendant, as Anya Takta, Rod, you remember Anya. She was teaching a retreat in England. And once the retreat was finished, they were driving from the retreat centre, I don't know where it was, to Heathrow Airport to get the plane, I think back to Germany where she was staying. And so they stopped halfway for lunch, you know, just before noon, because Ayakama was also, you know, a nun, she had to eat before midday. And for those of you who know, you know, England, many of the restaurants or the, you know, the cafeterias are actually next to a pub. Actually, they're part of the pub, but, you know, it's not the bar, it's just sort of, you know, adjoining. So they went into the restaurant, they had a nice lunch. And while, I don't know, Ayakama was just finishing off, Anya sort of went outside, and just in the front of the pub they had one of these pokey machines, they call in Australia, these slot machines, you know, where you have the jackpot. And the only reason this Anya was putting money in there, she had some old English coins, and just getting rid of them before going to the airport, because you can't change just, you know, little coins. And so she's putting them in there, putting them in. Now it's only a few coins, getting nowhere. And then she put a coin in, and just as she put the coin in, Ayakama walked past. And so Anya said to her, look, you've got all the good karma, you pull the thing. Now, monks and nuns should never do this, because what happened next? She pulled the thing, and absolutely true, jackpot. She got the jackpot. And all this money started pouring out of the machine, more and more money coming out of the machine. And because it was right in front of the pub, all the patrons in the pub, they heard this, and everything went quiet, just the sound of money pouring out. And the next sound was the barman rang the bell, ding, 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 ding. Because when the jackpot's won, the person who won the jackpot, this Buddhist nun, had to buy a free round of drinks for everyone in the pub. She had no choice, so a Buddhist nun, a very famous Buddhist nun, Ayakama, had to buy a round of drinks for everybody in the pub that day. That's the danger of gambling. Even small stuff. That's a true story. It's fascinating. Because Anyatakta was the one who was with her at the time. Okay, so that's what happens when you do lots of meditation. Dear Ajahn, this morning you mentioned what the lawyer who hid in his office cupboard to do meditation during lunch break. What happened if he goes into deep meditation and he sees nimitta and goes into jhana state in the cupboard? How will this affect his work after the meditation? Is it possible for a layperson who's been meditating for quite a while, many years, to reach jhana states and get enlightened? If so, how would it affect their family life? Thank you. There was a person who, as some of you know, this fellow, but he was going to Sri Lanka. Because there was this time, there was this teacher over there, and people were going there and they're coming back, and this teacher was saying, you know, you're now a stream winner, and you've got jhanas, and you've got this. And so it was very funny, because he was over in Sri Lanka, and his wife was over here. And she kept on coming to the monastery and saying, it's amazing. Sort of, you know, my husband has just rang up, and the teacher said he's now a stream winner. I'm so excited, it's wonderful. And then a couple of days later, another phone call, he's now a once returner. Oh, it's amazing, just, you know, that he can do this so quickly. And then there's the next few more days later, a phone call, he was a non-returner, anagami. And that's when she get worried. She said, come home quickly, because I want you to pay off the mortgage before you get fully enlightened. That's what she said. So number one, yeah, it is possible that people can get jhanas and they can get stages of enlightenment just as they did before. And if you do go into a deep meditation when you're in your cupboard, if it really is a deep meditation afterwards when you come out, your mind will be so clear. You'll be able to sort of read the mind of your opposite lawyer in the courtroom and completely sort of bamboozle him. And no matter what, no, well, I don't know if that's what happens, but anyway, you have such a clear mind, such a precise and powerful mind. You know, that what you lose in the hours you don't sort of work, you'll gain in the precision of your mind afterwards. So you'll be incredibly sharp. And you'll be able to see the problems and see solutions, which you just don't have the strength of mind to see otherwise. But usually what happens if a person gets that deep, and because they're a lawyer, it's a very difficult job. If they're half an hour in a cupboard, it's not really long enough to get into a jhana. They'll probably just get their mind nice and peaceful. But if they did, and they had that very, very powerful mind, they'll just make the resolution, I'll only be in meditation for half an hour, come out afterwards. And if you make those resolutions, you can actually control the length of time you go into deep states. So that's actually how you work it. So if you start getting into jhanas a lot, then you have to start making these resolutions. I've got to come out by a certain time. I think you're right. Yes, so do I. That medical research actually cautions against... Okay, getting out of bed quickly thing again. I think you're right. That medical research actually cautions against getting out of bed quickly to rush to the toilet, not to the meditation. So I think we are safe. I think you're safe too. I don't know what this actual medical research was. Because, I mean, how can they actually do this? Because, you know, they've got to sort of take samples. And, you know, they have to sort of get a person, sort of to tell them to get out. Is it just chance? They just actually put CCTV cameras in many, many bedrooms and just see who gets up fast and who gets up slowly. Because, you know, not only a few people like, you know, strange monks get up that quickly in the morning. Most people get up very, very slowly. So it's very hard to find anybody who gets up quickly and jumps out of bed and says zippity-doo-dah. There's only a few crazy monks like me. And so I can't see how they found that out. So anyway, if they rush to go to the toilet, not to the meditation, I think we are safe. But sometimes you do rush to get to that toilet, so be careful next time. I find it difficult to show loving kindness to the fault-finding mind. There is fear that if I do so, it will lead me in a direction I would later regret. If I let go of the fault-finding mind, I'm afraid that I'm actually in denial of reality. I feel stuck. Please advise. Thank you. Okay, just let go of the thinking mind. Because the fault-finding mind is the problem, but if you're loving kindness to the fault-finding mind, that's a way of subverting, getting around the fault-finding mind so it actually stops. Because again, if you've got a fault-finding mind and you find fault with the fault-finding mind, that's more fault-finding. So actually, how do you stop the fault-finding mind? Already you say the fault-finding mind is wrong. And so I'm in a bind there. So once you notice that fault-finding mind, and you can actually see where it comes from, it's just a bad habit, and you don't find fault with the fault-finding mind, what you do is actually you substitute this gratitude mind, this happy-to-be-here mind, this seeing the good in things mind, the contentment mind, that this is good enough, I'm happy to be here type of mind. And you understand that once you substitute that one, not through fault-finding, but saying this is a nice mind, and then it's easy to develop that fault-finding, develop that sort of peaceful opposite of fault-finding. And another way of doing that is, again, to have loving kindness to fault. Fault-finding mind, I'm not going to find fault with you. You're okay. Nice fault-finding mind. What's wrong with fault-finding anyway? I demand my right to be fault-finding. Who's this Ajahn Brahm to tell me I shouldn't find fault-finding? I demand freedom. Whatever. When you actually like your fault-finding mind, in a sense you'll have loving kindness towards it, you're not finding fault with it. So it completely changes immediately into not a fault-finding mind. It's a peaceful mind. It's a calm mind. So this is actually what we, just ways of getting rid of the fault-finding mind. And this is actually, a person wrote this, they understand that fault-finding mind is a problem for meditation, is just finding a way to overcome it. And they have a fear here saying that if I give up the fault-finding mind, I'm afraid that I'm in denial of reality. And gee, you make your reality. And in truth, that all reality, there's no such thing as actually reality as such, because we make our own different realities, we live in our own worlds. And the fault-finding world is just as valid as the positive attitude world. They're both as real. The only difference is the fault-finding mind leads to suffering, and the positive world mind leads out of suffering to peace, to freedom, eventually to enlightenment. So it's only more real in the sense it leads to enlightenment. Both are equally real. So choose your reality. It's not in denial of reality. You're not making a false idea of the world. You're just making a more positive, useful view of the world. One which will give you more happiness. Any questions about that? Ajahn Brahm, please explain the difference between vipassana meditation and samatha meditation. Which is easier? Also, does metta meditation lead you to nimitta and jhanas? Thank you. What's the difference? I told you the difference this morning. Vipassana meditation is developing meditation so you can have deep insights and wonderful views. And samatha is so you can have very still, calm, peaceful mind. But the point is that you can't have deep insights without peace. And you can't have peace without insight. The two go together. That's why it's just, as Ajahn Chah used to say, and this is what he'd do, he'd hold his hand out and see, what can you see now? You can see the front of my hand. But I'll tell you a secret, the back of the hand is just right behind. Now you see the back of the hand, you can't see the front of the hand, but that front of the hand is still there. This is like, this is vipassana. Can you see vipassana? You can see vipassana here, that's what's very clear, but samatha is right behind. Now you see samatha, but vipassana is right behind. Like the back and front of a hand. That's all they are. They cannot be split up. If Vipassana is going in front, samatha is right behind. If samatha is going in front, vipassana is right behind. They always have to go together. So never think this is samatha meditation or vipassana meditation. It's just meditation. That's all. And that whole idea that was came from the... Actually, it started off in the Abhidhamma. And they really messed up a lot of things in Buddhism. And it wasn't the word of the Buddha, the Abhidhamma. That came way after the time of the Buddha. It started there and got into the commentaries. And it's wonderful, like being a Western monk, because we are far more critical. And we're allowed to question. Because many of you, like say, growing up in Sri Lanka or in Thailand, suddenly don't question the monks. You're not allowed to. But Westerners, we always question everybody. Which is great, because we question this, and we look at those suttas, we study the Pali, we learn what's going on. You just can't, you cannot maintain these days that difference. And what's really crazy is that, you know, some, even monks these days, they go around saying, Satipatthana is vipassana meditation. Which, gee, that's not vipassana meditation. If you ever read any of the Satipatthana suttas, you never see vipassana mentioned once in that sutta. You do see jhanas mentioned. But it's just because it's a tradition which has come and people haven't questioned enough. But if you question it and look for yourself, it's very, very, very clear. And if anyone is really interested, when you go home, look in, say, the Anapanasati Sutta, which is the 108th sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya. And there you will see that anyone who fulfills Anapanasati, who does the meditation on the breath, exactly what you're doing here, to the jhanas and beyond, then you fulfill all the four Satipatthanas. The body Satipatthana, the Vedana, the feeling Satipatthana, the Chitta Satipatthana, and the Dhamma Satipatthana. So actually Satipatthana meditation is Anapanasati. Not different. That is the word of the Buddha. It's not only in the Satipatthana Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, it's all in, also in the Satipatthana Samyutta, in the Samyutta Nikaya. So it's great when you actually look these things up for yourself and think, my goodness, that's right. There is no sort of difference between Vipassana and Samatha. There is no sort of Satipatthana is, you know, Vipassana meditation. Satipatthana is Samatha, Anapanasati, which is what you've been doing in the last few days. So that's actually great to actually to see all those things. And it makes it so clear. You don't have to believe this monk or that monk. You look at the, what the Buddha said and believe that. And so which is easier? They're both the same, so they're both as hard as each other. And metta meditation, sometimes, it's all exactly the same. It's all letting go meditation. The door of my heart is open to the breath. The door of my heart is open to this moment. That's metta. So, what I usually teach, if a person's having a hard time doing the breath meditation, I say, stop doing the breath. I'll teach you Anapanasati instead. And if they can't do Anapanasati meditation, then I'll teach them metta meditation. Just being with the breath. Kindly. And if they can't do metta meditation, do loving kindness meditation on the breath. The door of my heart's open to this breath, no matter what it is. And if they can't do that, then I teach them vipassana meditation. I say, just watch the breath go in, watch the breath go out, and see what it does. In other words, basically, there's only one type of meditation. Just a meditation which leads to peace and stillness and freedom and bliss and enlightenment. But sometimes we just go at it from different angles. Stress different aspects of the meditation path. But it's really just one path. Calming the mind, brightening the mind, making it happy, making it still. Seeing the Dhamma. And actually that path is very beautifully said in these little stages of development. Now it usually starts from, well, it actually starts from many places, but it usually gets to this word like gladness or delight, pamuja. When that arises in the mind, then one gets this piti, this like joy. And when they get joy, the body becomes tranquil. In other words, it just fades away because you're happy inside. When the body becomes tranquil, the mind becomes still. When the mind becomes still, you get this inner happiness, this joy of meditation. And that joy of meditation is what leads to this, the deeper stillness of samadhi and the jhanas. And it's the jhanas which lead to seeing things as they truly are. And seeing things as they truly are leads to enlightenment. It's a very simple progression which reoccurs so many times in the suttas. It's a common teaching, just how cause and effect worked. You know, from sort of delight, you really get into the meditation, you love to do it. Or you like the breath, you get a bit of joy with the breath, you get pity, then you get tranquility. And the tranquility leads to deeper meditation, the deeper meditation leads to the jhanas, the jhanas, you see things as they truly are. And then you're home, enlightened. That's the path, that's meditation. And this is what you do here. Stillness. I'm going to talk maybe tomorrow about where the insight actually fits into this. But really it's only just the same old path. Call the Eightfold Path if you wish. Durajan, could you talk more about how to make your meditation object more beautiful, give it more value, etc.? Does this happen automatically as mindfulness becomes stronger, and why? It does become or happen automatically because whatever you experience becomes happier and more joyful the more the mindfulness comes up. That's why I said the bricks look beautiful, the carpet looks like a work of art, and your breakfast, the muesli, oh, that's just amazing muesli in the morning, because your mind wakes up, you taste more, you feel more, and what you taste and what you feel more is just more delicious, more beautiful. The simile of that hillside, when I slow down and stop, that hillside was beautiful. Now the beauty wasn't in the hillside, it was the beauty was in my mind. So that when you get still and the energies build up, everything becomes really beautiful. Whatever you see. And that's a lovely experience to have. You understand that, you know, that when the mind is happy, all the world is happy. So this is actually where you find that happiness comes from. So when you're watching the breath, once the mindfulness builds up, oh, it's just so nice, and so easy, and so peaceful, and so delicious. So that's where it comes from, essentially. But before that actually happens, to get it along, you actually look for the beautiful part. The fault-finding mind always looks for what's wrong. So you develop the mind like you go home. And you see, look in the kitchen. And you look not just at the dishes in the sink which need to be washed. You look at the dishes on the shelves which have already been washed. And you think, which is the more? And if there's the majority have already been washed, then okay, you're ahead. Go watch the TV. But then you have that positive mind state. You see what's more, what's going on. So you're not so critical, which means you have less work to do. Some perfectionists, they can never rest. They always have to keep on working again and again and again. Because they're fault finders. People with a positive mind, oh, they can take a break. Yeah, well, I've cleaned 2/3 of the gutters. That means the majority is clean. I'll leave the other one to another day. Who knows? You know, the plane might crash into my house and what a waste of time just having cleaned the gutters. Whatever. So just enjoy the life and just never do today what you can put off till tomorrow. And that's not a joke, that's a lot of wisdom about that. If it's not necessary to do today, why do it today? Meditate instead. So anyway, I forgot what the question was, but anyway, that's good enough. I've answered most of the question. Dear Ajahn, my best friend is a Buddhist, and she believes in forgiveness 100%. Her husband cheated her 4 times, and she took him back and forgave him. He is a so-so husband, and we all know that he will cheat on her again. How do you know he'll cheat on her again? The future is uncertain. Now, he may have seen the error of his ways. So, we also know that she will forgive him again and take him back. She appears happy, but I know that she loves him less and less. Is she being a good Buddhist or just being silly to be with a man who cannot keep the marital vow? Okay, because sometimes you have to help him keep that marital vow. So chain him up. I don't know. But it's forgiveness, always err on the side of forgiveness. Because, I mean, that's a wonderful thing to err on the side of, because there's something always really, really beautiful about forgiveness. She doesn't need to forgive him. And she'll be in her rights four times, usually, you know, three times. We do, you know, duty umpy, tatty umpy. But she's done four times. So that's amazing what she's done. And, you know, if that husband's got any sense, you know, wow, what a wonderful woman that is. You know, who's just, you know, so selfless and so kind that she's forgiven him four times. And any sensible man will think, my goodness, she's such a treasure, there will never be a fifth time. That's what a man should do. And so it's great if she forgives him. But she's not being silly, she's being wonderful and amazing. And because she's making such wonderful good karma, if not in this life, another life, she'll get sort of a husband who's just incredibly faithful to her and never sort of let her down at all. So it's, I can never sort of say no to good karma. So forgive, 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 forgive. You don't know, you know, the fourth time might be the end of it. Dear Ajahn, I was meditating in the field this afternoon. Just as I was getting a glimpse of a nimitta, I heard a ferocious growl. Not from my tummy, somewhere on my right. I told myself to ignore it. As I'm being protected, it's the correct way to respond. Thank you. It's probably, what time was it? Was it, if it was before lunch, it was probably somebody's tummy growling. Not your tummy, somebody else's tummy. Somewhere on my right. I'm not sure there's no sort of tigers or dogs anywhere around here. It could have been one of those Willy Wagtails. Do they growl? No, I'm sure they don't. The ferocious growl. Sometimes you're getting close to a nimitta. Remember, this is the time that perceptions can start to play tricks on you. Because sometimes the perception is really amazing what it can do. It can amplify things out of all proportion. I mentioned to many people that story that once I was meditating in the jungle in Thailand, and it was really peaceful and quiet. And then I heard the sound of an animal. Because, you know, when it's the evening time, animals come out. And I was very mindful, and not being silly at all, I just, you know, what's that sound? And as I examined it with my mind, very mindfully, very carefully, it was actually, okay, it's the largest animal. It's not one of these small animals, it must be like a jungle cat or one of these civet cats or something. But as it came closer, I heard it again, and actually it was much bigger than the civet cat. Because, you know, you can actually see that big animals make big noises, and small animals, just even the noise and the cracking the twigs or the leaves is very, very different. And as it was coming closer towards me, I heard it and just examined it, because I was getting really concerned now. And so that's not the sound of a small animal at all, that's a tiger, I'm sure. So that's when I opened my eyes, and I saw it there, right in front of me, this tiny mouse. That's all it was. I think, gee, you're stupid. Because when there's any type of fear at all, the fear exaggerates things, and perception can play enormous tricks on you. And it's not even an average-sized mouse, it was much smaller than usual. And this is what perception does to you. So sometimes you can create a growl out of nothing. You can create a sort of a tiger out of a mouse. And there's nothing wrong with that. Don't feel you're being stupid. It's just the nature of the mind to do things like that. With your eyes closed, especially when you're getting powerful minds, perception can do amazing things. So it's probably, I would say, that growl was just like perception just playing around. Because you know there's nothing sort of dangerous, you know, in the grounds. It can't be sort of like a tiger escape from the zoo, because the zoo is a bit too far away. So just leave it alone. I think that's probably the answer. One of the perception tricks. And you are being protected in this place. Next question. Please explain the difference between samadhi and jhana. Okay. Samadhi is just like the stillness of a mind. So samadhi is a pretty general term. And when it gets that still that you cannot feel your body and you cannot hear sounds and you're blissed out of your skull and having a wonderful time, not for a moment, for many moments, you sit there for 3 hours and you come out which is so, so lovely and so peaceful. And that's sort of like the jhana experiences. No thinking and the body's completely disappeared. You can't hear things. You can't even feel things. So the five senses have stopped and the body's disappeared. You're right in the mind. So that's the jhanas. However, what the Buddha said is sama samadhi, or the perfect or true samadhi, or the samadhi of the Eightfold Path, he said that is always jhanas. Jhana, 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 jhana. So sama samadhi, like correct or perfect samadhi, is always jhanas. That's why in the, was it Gopika Moggallana Sutta, the Buddha said, actually it was Ananda quoting the Buddha, the only meditation the Buddha praised, was first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. Nothing else. So the jhanas are the meditation the Buddha recommended. He never recommended anything less. Could you again go through the steps of developing awareness that will concentrate the mind to a point where the mind sees the breath as its most desired object and will not wish to enter into the past or future to engage mind objects there? That's about 4 days of talks to go through that again. So just in brief, developing awareness, okay. First of all, to develop awareness, be still, don't do very much, just relax, don't force, don't strive, take enough rest, just take it easy, be in the moment, don't know past, no future, try and get into the silence. And that degree of stillness and non-doing will build up the mindfulness so you get more awake, you'll be able to see deeper, what you see becomes more happy. So develop the awareness first, build it up. So you feel very alert and very awake. What you taste is very easy to taste and it's delicious food and you get more energy and you feel a little bit happier because you're more positive. Build up the power of mindfulness first of all. And once the mindfulness is powerful enough, then whatever your meditation object is, if it hasn't got intrinsic beauty, then you can start making a little commentary up. If it is the breath, how important the breath is to you. And just how grateful you are for this breath. It's brought oxygen into your body ever since you were born. Have you ever said thank you to your breath for doing that? It's taken all this stuff out. Even when you're asleep, it takes all the waste products out. It's been doing this without asking for anything back in return. And now you say, oh, thank you, breath. You've been so kind to me, kept me alive. Get me with this oxygen, which is important for my energy. You've been so nice to me. Then you get this feeling of gratitude and care for your breath. And when you have this caring for your breath, then it becomes, oh, quite nice, quite beautiful. Whatever you care for brings you happiness. So care for your breath. Don't just watch it, breath going in, breath going out, boring. What do I have to do this for? Put a bit of life and energy into it and care. And it becomes delightful then. Okay, if you want to know more, get the tapes. Dear Ajahn, can you comment on understanding is not realization? Realization is not enlightenment. In meditation I'll come to have some amazing understanding, but how do I use that for my realization and ultimate awakening? Understanding is not realization. I don't know what the person meant by that, but it could be like just understanding the words, knowing the theory. Maybe that means the menu is not the food. So, understanding is a menu, realization is the food, and enlightenment is a feeling, oh, I've had a lovely meal today. So you're satisfied, and you don't want to eat any more. So, maybe what this means is the words of the understanding, the realization is when you taste that food, you actually follow those words and and you realize what they're describing, and a feeling of satisfaction, of freedom from desire, because now you've ate the food and you're satisfied. But with enlightenment, you don't have to go to the shop and get more enlightenment tomorrow. Once enlightened, you're full forever. Actually, it reminds me of that story of this guy. I read it in newspapers. There's always some really interesting, weird stuff in newspapers. That's one of the reasons I read it. Here's that this guy. He was raising cows, and just to get them a heavier weight before he sent them to market, he fed them concrete. Disgusting thing to do. They weighed a lot, but they didn't live very long. He thought, well, I'll feed them once. That's the last time I'm going to feed them. Anyway, I'm often asked by non-Buddhist friends and others the question, what is meditation? Why do you meditate? Do you meditate to solve problems? What should be short and appropriate answers in such situations? It reminds me of that story when I was at Wat Pa Phong with Ajahn Chah. Meditation started to become known in the Western world, and the Swedish government heard about this, and they decided to send over a researcher who was a professor from, I think it was Uppsala University, if I remember correctly. I think that was, I've got a good memory there. And he came from Uppsala University all the way, and not just to Thailand, he went to India first and then went to some of the meditation monks in Thailand. And because he was a professor, if you're going to do research, you have to ask the same questions of every master. So he had four questions, and he was going around asking all the great meditation teachers the same four questions so he could standardize his research. And the four questions was very similar to this. What is meditation? Why do you meditate? How do you meditate? And what do you get out of meditation? Those are the four questions. So when he came to see Ajahn Chah, someone translated this, a professor was come from the Swedish government. You know, so this is important. And he's come to ask you four questions. Quote, what is meditation? Why do you meditate? How do you meditate? And what do you get out of meditation? And then Ajahn Chah said, can I have a piece of paper and a pencil? And when he said that, he'd never done that before. It was a key. We knew he was up to one of his tricks again. This was going to be interesting and fun. Because he was an actor as well. So he got a piece of paper, and then he scratched his head. I've never seen him do that before either. He's really playing around. And then he wrote out four answers, and he gave it to translate. And the translator, he looked at them and laughed. And then he sort of told the professor, he said, the master, Ajahn Chah, says the answer to your first question, what is meditation? The master's answer is, what is eating? The answer to your second question, why do you meditate? His answer is, why do you eat? How do you meditate? The answer is, you've got it, how do you eat? And what do you get out of meditation? His answer is, what do you get out of eating? And the professor was not happy. He said, I can't take those back to my government. And Ajahn Chah said, that's all you're getting. They're brilliant answers. It wasn't just a joke, because Ajahn Chah was funny, but it was profound at the same time. What is eating? Why do you eat? How do you eat? Has anyone ever taught you how to eat? Maybe they teach you table manners. There's something very natural about eating. There's very natural about meditating. And if you get all the advice out of the way, and all the etiquette, and just, you know, shove the food in your mouth, just shove the breath in your brain, in your mindfulness, and just stop it, you know, worrying about how you're supposed to do it, and enjoy it, then that's how you eat. So there's a lot of natural attitudes to the path of meditation, and that's what I've been trying to encourage during this retreat here. Really, sometimes you really need to teach somebody how to eat. All you have to do is teach them what not to do. Now, the mistakes about eating too much or not in the right order, or stuffing too much in them, not chewing long enough before you swallow, whatever. And you know you're eating well because it feels nice, it's happy, it's, you know, it goes down the throat without getting stuck. So it's the same with meditation. You know you're doing it right because it feels right. There's a natural feedback mechanism that you know, yeah, you're meditating correctly now because it feels good. And that's, you know, what is meditation, what is eating? Meditation is, eating is food for the body, meditation is food for the heart. It makes you feel healthy in your spiritual heart. And so why do you do it? For that very reason, for you feel better afterwards. You feel healthier, And with a fit body, you can achieve all sorts of things. With a fit mind, you can achieve many things, including enlightenment. That's how you meditate, why you meditate, what you get out of meditation. Out of eating, you get a peaceful body. Out of no hunger. Out of meditation, you get a mind free from craving, satisfied. So that's actually great answers. That's from Ajahn Chah to these questions. What is meditation? The answer is, what is eating? Why do you meditate? Why do you eat? Do you meditate to solve problems? Do you eat to solve problems? Yeah, the problem of hunger and lack of energy. So, those are nice deep questions, deep answers to deep questions. And when you tell that to a person, instead of giving them simple answers, which, you know, you have to elaborate on, that sort of almost encapsulates the answers. That's why I always remember that. It was a very wonderful answer by Ajahn Chah to a government question. Any comments on that? Okay. Dear Ajahn Param, could you please talk a little more about the doer and the knower? It's still not very clear to me. Is it the mind equals the doer and mind equals the knower and mindfulness is the doer? Thank you, with metta. Okay, it's like will is part of the doer. Now, what originates sort of actions of body, speech or mind? Now, the reaction to what you hear or feel or see or know, that's the doer. It does things. It's like that part of the mind which initiates action, generates activity, which disturbs the stillness. The active mind. The other one is like consciousness, mindfulness, awareness. It's passive. It doesn't do anything. It just knows. Like, there's part of the mind which can hear what I'm saying. There's another part of the mind which actually reacts to it. Yeah, this is good, or this is not clear, or, you know, this is stupid, or whatever. That's the reactive mind. What hears is the passive mind. That's the knower. The reacting, the thinking, the judging, the, you know, I don't like this, I'm going to walk out. What starts movement is the doer. Is that any clearer? Hopefully, you're very, very passive. So that's the knower. If you start to do something and react, that's the doer. The knower and the doer. Basically, it's consciousness and will. Consciousness is the knower. Will is the doer. And you'll find in this meditation, as you go deeper and deeper and deeper, the will stops. And that's the experience in second jhana, where incredible experience. You cannot do anything. The potential to do is gone. You can't form a will. You can't originate a movement in the body or the mind. You're stuck. Wonderfully so still, you can't move. Some of you had experience you can't move the body in meditation. You're sitting here and you just can't move it. Now in the second jhana it's like that, but you can't move the mind now. It's not just the body, it's just the mind. It's impossible to move. Now that's where the will has disappeared. It's not at your fingertips anymore. It's not you're not doing anything, it's you can't do anything. The potential, the ability is taken away from you. And that's weird. But that gives you incredibly deep insight into the nature of what will is and the doer is. So the second jhana, the doer stops. As you go deeper through the jhanas, consciousness just peels away and gets so refined until it too stops. The knower stops. So who's left when the doer is gone and the knower has faded to nothing? Who's left? I will tell you tomorrow morning. Okay. It's nice to have mysteries during the retreat. It is always something that through meditation one attains... it's always said that through meditation one attains wisdom. What exactly is wisdom? Thank you, Ajahn. I'll leave this question to the talk on insight tomorrow, because it will show why you need meditation, why you need stillness, actually, to see things as they truly are. So that'll be answered tomorrow. So I'll put it aside for the talk tomorrow. We'll also say, what happens when the knower and the doer both disappear? What is the benefit of formally taking the five precepts? How does one go about this, and what obligations are necessary once taking them, apart from keeping them? Yeah, that's the most important one. Once you take them, you've got to care for them. Because sometimes that people do this, they take those five precepts, and do they keep them? No, before even they said, no, after Parnati Pata Weramani, you know, refrain from killing animals, and by the doing Adi Nadana, Weramani Sikkhana. They kill an insect while they've even taken the five precepts. Gee. And I've seen some Sri Lankans who actually keep the five precepts on Wesak Day, and they go out the back, even in the car park. They open up the boot of the car, and that's where the whiskey is. So they celebrate the five precepts on Wesak Day with a shot of whiskey. Here's the five precepts. So that is really sort of disrespect, because you're just saying the words, you're not understanding the meaning. So five precepts is just making a determination, this is what I'm going to do. So if you're going to be honest, then if that's what you're going to do, do it. If you're not going to do it, then don't say it. And that's actually how one takes the five precepts, and you don't need to formally take them. It was my story as a Buddhist. When I really got into Buddhism, I actually learned about Buddhism when I was still at school, the last year or two at school. And then when I went to Cambridge, there's a great Buddhist society there, so I really got into it. But also when I was at London, I used to go to the Thai temple. And I used to go to the Thai temple regularly over there. And one day, one of the Thai monks took me aside and said, you know, you've been coming here a long time. It's about time you took the five precepts. And this is a true story. I told that monk, said, what do you mean five precepts? What are the five precepts? He said, "Now, not deliberately killing a living being, not taking what's not given, sort of not committing adultery, not lying, and not taking alcohol or drugs." And I was quite cheeky, but I never realized I was cheeky, because I didn't really know what respect was towards a monk at that time. I told this monk, "You know, Venerable Sir, I don't need to take those precepts. I've been keeping them for a couple of years already. What do I need to take them for?" That's how I felt, because I had been keeping them. And at that time I was a vegetarian, I was didn't take any alcohol or drugs, I was very good at all these things. I'd always pay the fares on the buses, and I'd be scrupulously honest. And, you know, I wasn't breaking any precepts. Because I found that out just from my reading and from listening to the sermons which I got at Cambridge. So I was keeping them, said, why do I need to take them? And that sort of dumbfounded him, because, you know, very often you're supposed to take the precepts before you keep them, but I kept them before I took them. If you know what I mean. So you don't need to formally take them. What's more important is you actually keep them. And you only sort of formally take them just to almost like remind yourself, or if you're having trouble keeping them, to remind yourself what they are. Dear Bhante, doing crossword puzzles or learning another language is supposed to increase intelligence and prevent dementia. Meditation is also supposed to do this. How could these two opposite ways bring about the same result? I don't know if they're really opposite ways. It's just training the mind. And if you really develop deep meditation, I'm sure you can do the crossword puzzles much quicker. You can see the answers through the psychic powers. But I don't know. It's still good to do both. Or whatever else is, because you, in the lay world, you won't always be able to meditate. And, you know, sometimes you'll do a crossword puzzle, or you do something else, Sudoku or whatever else, you know, maybe sort of, you know, you're learning a language, or you're researching or reading something. Sometimes that just keeps that part of the mind which can analyze and can work things out and problem solve, it keeps it alive and well, which is useful. But I think the meditation will probably be more powerful than sort of, you know, the exercise of, you know, the mind through puzzles and stuff. Because I always say that, you know, what you're doing here, increasing your mindfulness, the energy, the knowing, and that always increases the memory. So I think that the practice of mindfulness, especially, you know, through meditation, I think I don't know if it has been researched, but maybe it hasn't been known long enough, but I'd really suspect that people who do lots of meditation just do not get Alzheimer's, do not get dementia. And if I do get dementia, I'd have forgot I ever said that, so I'm safe. Dear Ajahn Brahm, you mentioned earlier this week that some people experience such an emotional high in meditation they even start crying. At what stage would this happen? Be beautiful breath nimitta or jhanas? In the jhanas, you're beyond crying. And sometimes nimitta, especially the first nimitta, they become really, really strong, yeah. And sometimes you feel like crying. And it's also even like after jhanas as well. And sometimes you just feel so happy and so wonderful. I always remember just once I was teaching a retreat in Melbourne, and this lady, she'd been coming a long, long time. And, you know, I was just really so pleased when she got her first deep meditation. Because she was waiting for me out of the meditation hall, and crouching by the side of the path. And I can still visualize her now. She was looking up at me, just with these like really like doe eyes, and just almost crying, and saying, Ajahn Brahm, I've done it at last. It was so sweet, that just her excitement and a sort of deep pleasure. The nearest you can say is like someone just fallen in love. But not with a person, they just had a jhana experience. And just they're so soft and stupid. And it's so nice to see that. Because they're just so happy and so joyful. And now a bit sort of soft in the head because they just got a beautiful experience. So it's wonderful when that happens. And you can start crying then. You're crying because you've got so much joy. Incredible happiness. And you just burst out crying. Inspiration does that to you as well. For those of you going on the India trips, sometimes you go to some places and you just burst out crying. There's one of the ladies who went on the last trip when I went on, that was a couple of years ago. And because I've been on these trips before, some of you know her very well. I won't say who it is. But I gave the sort of the briefing beforehand, look, you've got some very powerful places on these pilgrimage spots. And there's some of you will get emotionally overwhelmed there and may even start crying. And apparently that when I said this, you know, she thought, come off it, you know, that's just exaggerating things. It's only like old ruins, you know, she's been to Greece, she's been to Rome, it's just old stones, and that's hundreds of years ago when the Buddha lived there. And she told me afterwards that, you know, she came to apologize to me. Because the first place we went to in Bodh Gaya, she just walked into the Mahabodhi temple. She just walked in. And she started weeping. She couldn't control herself. She completely wept her eyes out and was very embarrassed. And she said, I don't know why this happened, but gee, you were right. And that's why she apologized to me. Some of those places have incredible power. And people feel it. And she never expected it. She thought it was silly that such things could happen. You know, she was English. And she just cried. So sometimes that happens. You get inspiration, you just get so happy and you start crying. The last question for today. Sometimes when I sit here, I wonder what I'm trying to do. Oh, after 5 days of teaching you, that's going to make me cry now. That's another reason for crying. I'm just depression. I go and kill myself. What do you mean? What I'm trying to do? Okay, now I'll tell the whole question. I'm only messing around. Sometimes when I sit here, I wonder what I'm trying to do. In seeking to escape suffering, am I seeking total annihilation, destruction, or permanent death in seeking nirvana? Permanent death is the answer. Well, you're going to die, you get born again, you have to go all over again. Gee, haven't you had enough getting born again? So say, haven't you had enough nappies? Do you remember what it's like wearing a nappy? Sorting your pants? And always having crying and mum never understanding what you mean. And you're going to do that all over again. Gee, you've got to go to school again. And all of those who've, you know, finally got divorced or whatever, you're going to have to get married again. Oh, no, not again. Gee. Do you want to do it all over again? So have the permanent death is on offer here. Die once and forever with Ajahn Brahm's meditation retreat. Okay. So what you're doing is having a bit of peace. So forget about Nirvana and permanent death and all that sort of stuff. Have a bit of permanent peace, at least it's temporary peace, even a momentary peace, and a bit of silence and calm, and just have a bit of fun. Real happiness when you're so content. So just go for contentment. Forget about the death and Nirvana business. Okay, so I think that's enough for now. So now you can go and have a temporary death on your beds, and I'll see you resurrected in the morning, maybe. Good night. Okay.